Hello, and welcome to Endeavors. It's episode 109, at least according to the RSS feed. And it's going to be a good one today. As those who know me probably know, I am a massive, massive baseball fan, particularly when it comes to the Toronto Blue Jays. And I'm so excited to actually be living in Toronto now and maybe having a chance to go to a couple games a year. But I tried to do one or two baseball shows a year, usually either around opening day, the All-Star Game, or the World Series, or if there's a baseball movie or documentary that comes out at some point during the year. And today is one of those baseball shows. I have always been a big fan of baseball movies, and you can ask people, you know, what they think the greatest ones are. A few will always come up. You've got your Field of Dreams. You've got your Major League. You've got your Pride of the Yankees. You've got your Bull Durham. And then there's The Sandlot, which I loved as a kid. Of course, if you're not familiar, it's about nine friends in 1962 who play ball on this sort of old field that is overlooked by a house that's supposed to have a mean man and his equally mean dog. It was released in April of 1993, which means that this year is the 25th anniversary of The Sandlot. And even some major league teams got in on the action. In spring training, a number of the Milwaukee Brewers recreated one of the iconic scenes in the movie. And in 2005, there was a sequel released, The Sandlot 2. But the original film will always, always, always be in the hearts of millions of fans. And as the director, David Mickey Evans, says, it's now third generations of fans that are seeing it. I got to speak with the director of the film, the writer-director of the film, David Mickey Evans. And we talk about the film and why it's been so beloved after all these years. As the rap said, it's the cult film that will never, ever, ever die. People will always, always love it. But both of us being baseball fans, we couldn't help but talk about the 2018 season. And even though we both bleed sort of white and blue, it's two very different white and blues. His is Dodger blue, and I am Blue Jays. But we did find similarities in terms of talking about years of futility, I guess, that our teams had, with, you know, the last couple of years being the exception. And of course, I asked David on his favorite Dodgers moment and the greatest Dodgers player in The Sandlot, and also why he keeps coming back to baseball movies. So this is my conversation with Sandlot writer-director David Mickey Evans. David Mickey Evans, hello, welcome to the show. Thanks so much for being here today.
No, it's my pleasure. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it.
How does it feel that 25 years after you made this little movie that people are still talking about it and still care so deeply about it?
Oh, man. Well, the first thing I feel about that is intensely grateful. I mean, you know, there's never any way to know when you're doing a picture if people are going to like it or if it's going to be successful. And if it's successful, you know, that the odds of that are very low. But that it became this sort of beloved classic is virtually impossible. And, you know, I understand a certain amount of why it's continued to be so popular into its, you know, third generation of fans and stuff. But really, if I could bottle that and sell it, you know, you'd never see me again. Somewhere along the line, it ceased to be my movie, and it's the fans' movie now. You know, this whole 25th anniversary thing has been remarkable so far, and we haven't even started this big tour we're doing with the picture all over the U.S. to Major League Baseball stadiums to screen it, and it's already like the number one DVD. Well, there's two actual anniversary DVDs out. One is a collector's edition, and they're both like number one right now, even before we've done our first event. So it's pretty remarkable.
Did you get a chance to see the little homage that the Milwaukee Brewers did?
Of course I did. Yeah, about 200 people sent me that clip. And I tweeted out a big shout-out to the Milwaukee Brewers, because I think they nailed it. It was terrific. You know, the Yankees did one a few years ago, but, you know, I don't know. This one was pretty darn good. I think it's the best one I've seen.
I think in terms of sports movies, films about baseball always hold a special place in cinema. Do you remember what it was that first inspired you to write a baseball film?
Sure, yeah. And, lots of people consider it a baseball film, which is, you know, fine. I don't think of it like that. To me, it's a movie about friendship that has some baseball in it. And I got the idea from an incident that happened to me and my little brother, well, to my little brother, actually. When we were kids, we lived on this block where we got bullied and nobody liked us, and, you know, nobody let us play baseball or basketball or any sports with them or anything like that. And my little brother and I were always together, but one day, for some reason, we weren't together, and these bullies were playing baseball down at the end of the street. So he goes down there to see if he can get the play, and they had hit a baseball over a brick wall into the backyard of this particular house. And there was actually a mean and vicious dog back there named Hercules. And in those days, you know, when you played baseball on the street, I'm talking, you know, on the asphalt, you had one baseball because this is, you know, we were very poor. You didn't have like a bucket of baseball. So if you hit one over the fence, you had to go get it. So none of these guys was going to jump over there and risk getting bit by that dog. But they told my little brother, go over there and get the ball and we'll let you play with us. So he said, okay. And he went over there, got the ball, and the dog was on a chain, broke the chain and bit him in the leg really bad. And, you know, so I took that unhappy memory and turned it into a happy memory.
Now, the film was set in 62, and obviously there's the iconic image of Smalls meeting the Babe. But I understand that there was initially another ball player that was going to be featured in a sort of subplot. Is that correct?
That's absolutely right. Yeah, the reason it's set in 62, pragmatically, is because that's the year that the great LA Dodger, Maury Wills, broke the stolen bases record. So that summer in 62, you know, you'd be listening to Dodger games on your little transistor radio with the pull-out antenna and the little earpiece and like that. Well, Squinch, his character, you know, actually filmed all this. He was listening to Dodger games all the time, and he would announce to the team, the satellite guys, when Maury Wills stole another base. And then Benny would go up to bat, and he was trying to keep pace with Maury Wills all through the summer to match him, you know, stolen base for stolen base. Well, that sort of all got cut out of the movie. For the life of me, I can't remember why. Probably because somebody wanted it 2 minutes shorter or whatever. But that's the reason it's in 62. I mean, you know, there's other reasons as well, but that was the major reason.
Now I know you're from you're initially from Pennsylvania. You moved to LA, so I gotta ask, Dodgers or Phillies?
Dude, Dodger blue. I've been bleeding Dodger blue since I was a kid, and I will always bleed Dodger blue. And when they botched the World Series last year, I can't tell you. I went into a funk for days.
It's okay. As a diehard Blue Jays fan, I feel your pain. We had we were we were futile there for many years, and until a couple years ago. Making a movie that has a lot of kids as the stars can always be an interesting experience. What was that like for you in terms of, getting them all together, directing them, and then sort of navigating them through the whirlwind that became this cult classic?
It's a deceptively difficult type of thing to do, is exactly what you just said. You've got nine young guys from 11 to 13 who have so much energy. It's off the charts, which is both a good thing and a bad thing, because they have a tendency to get distracted and that sort of thing. But these guys, all of these young guys, were remarkably able to focus when we needed to work, and then go burn off energy when we weren't. First couple of weeks were, tough, a bit like herding squirrels or cats. But they became, and I insisted on them all hanging out at the same hotel and all that, and they became really good buddies. I mean, they are to this day. Became, best friends. So that sort of clicked in about the beginning of the second week. And except for Benny, maybe Vic and Tommy, we're not particularly good baseball players, but we had a lot of practice as a great baseball coach. And by about the end of the second week, they were able to turn a double play and all that, and look pretty darn good doing it. So it's a matter, look, when you're a director, you have to be, equal parts psychologist, dad, big brother, so on and so on. And it's part of the job, and each of them needed to be communicated with in a slightly different manner. But as a group, since it's an ensemble piece, they all became of one mind about what we were doing and how it needed to be done. So they were all pretty mature, and after they became good buddies, I mean, Benny ended up being off camera and on camera, obviously, the sort of leader of the group, the guy that was in command, and everybody was cool with that. So it ended up being, I mean, it was a very difficult picture to shoot. I mean, they all are. Of course, we had all the dogs. It was 112 degrees that summer and all that. So, we had a lot of stuff to deal with, but they came together, and we had a great time. It's the best time I ever had making a picture.
I gotta ask, how many of them actually had a crush on Marley? I know Chauncey gets her in the film, but was there any competition in that regard?
Not that I recall, but I'll tell you, everybody had a crush on Marley. I think she was 18 or 19 at the time. The sweetest disposition you've ever seen in your life. Terrific actress. And she knew what the part was. I mean, she was playing an icon, And it was not very difficult at all to get them, when they're in the pool, to stare up at her with longing faces and, hearts aflutter, if you will. That was pretty effortless.
There was recently I read an article that said, where are they now? And I know Patrick, Tom, and Chauncey still act, but most of them have left the business. How often do you keep in touch with the kids?
Oh gosh, we're all Facebook buddies, so I see what they how they're doing in their lives all the time. I'm talking to them, not frequently, but not infrequently now. And we're gonna see each other during this tour, all the way through October. So, yeah, we're all good buddies and good friends, and they're all solid guys. I mean, they've all done in whatever endeavor they've done do very well.
I think it was the Wrap that posted it said why the 90s cult classic will live forever. What do you think makes a film timeless?
Oh, boy. Well, I think it has a lot to do with how the audience identifies with it, the characters and what they go through. And speaking for The Sandlot, it's set in 62. There's no cell phones in it. There's nothing like that. It's a summer as a moment caught in time. Those characters never age, and that film will never become anachronistic. It is what it is and where it is. That it has stood the test of time and always will, there's no question about that, is I think because no matter who you are, where you were, you grew up, everybody has similar experiences in life, going through adolescence and such. And I think audiences look at those characters and then they relate to them either as having been one of those characters or wishing they had been one of those characters. You know what I mean?
Yeah, yeah. And I know you actually, you know, 12 years after The Sandlot was released, you decided to revisit it in a way with new characters. What made you want to come back to that story?
I originally had 6 Sandlots written. You know, and they happened a decade apart, 62, 72, 82, 90, and so on. Even though in its initial theatrical release, because this was not an expensive film, this is a fairly low budget, it was enormously successful. It took the studio 12 years to decide to do a sequel. And, you know, The Sandlot's an anomaly. You know, if you try to get a kid-oriented baseball movie done today, good luck. It's virtually impossible at a studio. Because there is this thought process in the executive ranks that baseball movies don't travel. In other words, they don't do well overseas, and therefore they don't have that ancillary income, foreign sales, and blah, blah, blah. In the sense, in the Sandlot's case, that's absolutely untrue. It's a huge hit in Australia, Germany, Japan, and a lot of other places. Because it's essentially not a baseball movie. Again, it's about friendship, and it's about taking your first step out of childhood and into the sort of responsible world of being an adult. I mean, that's what The Fence is supposed to represent in the movie. And when Benny goes over there, he's essentially leaving his childhood behind. And I think the message gets through, you know, that it's baseball is because I'm a, you know, big baseball fan, and baseball is America's sport. I don't care what they say about football. And it's the greatest game that was ever invented. So, when Fox called me 12 years later, I mean, that was, you know, the height of the DVD world, and they have a certain formula for what they will make on direct-to-DVD pictures, and The Sandlot fit it, and they asked me if I wanted to do it. I said, sure, of course. So that was, I believe to this day, that Sandlot 2, a lot of people gave me guff about it, because how do you top The Sandlot? You can't, you know. Plus, The Sandlot 2 was made for, like, a third of the budget of the original in less than half the shooting schedule. So, you know, that one was tough.
And yet,
but nonetheless, I think it's the most successful direct-to-DVD live-action movie of all time.
And yet you still got James Earl Jones to come back and reprise his role. How much did that help in the making of both the sequel and the original, having somebody like him?
Well, I mean, it didn't hurt. I mean, the man's an international superstar in the acting world. I mean, he's one of the greatest actors of his or any other generation. And he's the nicest man you'd ever meet in your life. He's an incredibly gracious soul. And we had a great guy. I only had him for one day, a single day of shooting on the original Sandlot and a single day of shooting on the sequel. And, you know, I wanted to have Mr. Myrtle as number two, and we just phoned him up, and he was said, oh, yeah, absolutely, you know. He's quite fond of the movie, so he didn't have any problem coming back to help us out.
Casting someone to play Babe Ruth, I imagine, can pose a unique challenge. How did you go about finding the right actor for it and eventually settling on Art LaFleur?
I love Artie. Artie, since that day, we've been great friends ever since, and he's done a few other movies with me. And I think the way that worked out was we looked at a number of actors, and of course you're looking for a particular man of size, a particular size and a look and all that. a good writer friend, a great writer friend of mine, great friend and great writer, Vince McKeown, I think, introduced me to Artie because they've been friends for years. And I met him. I took one look at him. He's got the greatest sense of humor you ever see. And I said, and he always wanted to play the Babe. He had this dream that one day he would be able to play Babe Ruth. And because Artie was a big football guy and a big sports guy in high school and college. And so that was easy. I cast him the minute I met him.
How were his baseball skills? Because I know he had appeared in a couple of baseball films previously, most notably Field of Dreams.
Yeah, no, Artie can throw a ball like a pro, and he can hit like a pro. He's really, I mean, he's older now, but I mean, he was an athlete. There's no question about it.
You know, you've made two other baseball films in addition to The Sandlot, Ed and The Final Season. Why do you think you keep revisiting that sport?
It's probably a couple of reasons. One, I get offered those, like, you know, because of The Sandlot, I get offered those pictures all the time. And if, if it has baseball, it's baseball. But it's really, what's the story about? If the story interests me, or I think I can do a good job on it, then, you know, odds are I'll take the gig. The Final Season was a tremendous story, and a tremendous, you know, feat in high school sports history, so I wanted to tell that picture. And Ed, I didn't direct that, I wrote it. And I sort of ended up in my career having made what's been called the greatest baseball movie ever made, The Sandlot, and also the worst baseball movie ever made, which was Ed. So, you know, what can I say? You know, I didn't direct the picture, but the script was really good, trust me.
You know, it's been 25 years since The Sandlot came out. How do you find that in the years since it's come out, cinema has changed, but also sports films? How do you think they've been handled in the last couple of decades?
It's changed and it hasn't changed. I thought 42 was a beautiful movie. I liked it very much. There's been other attempts. Football's always a background against which movies get told. The last few football movies I've seen have been really not good at all. In fact, bad. And when those don't do so well, then it's, you know, becomes increasingly and subsequently more difficult to get a picture that's got some sort of sports-oriented material in it funded. I thought, I don't know how many years ago this was, but Friday Night Lights was a terrific film. The Rookie, I liked The Rookie very much. You know, all that sort of thing. In this day and age, look, movie making itself has changed. You know, it's nothing like what it was when I was making The Sandlot. During those days, in the early 90s, mid-90s, even up in the early aughts, you could get, you know, an $8 to $15 million movie made, you know, because the script was terrific. If it was sports oriented, with, you know, little difficulty. And today, you know, it's always been about the bottom dollar, but today it's, you know, I mean, you're talking about hundreds of millions of dollars. And studios just don't make those kinds of films. They used to make, you know, 100 films a year, and now they're making 20 or 30 films a year. They're all Marvel Comics movies, expensive CG sorts of movies. So, you know, if you want to make something the sports artist says, something like The Sandlot. In fact, I have a new project that I wrote called Junior Americans, which is about, takes place against the background of National American Little League. You have to go the indie route, and it takes a long time to cobble the money together to get to do it. But if the story's good, you know, it's worth the it's worth the hassle and the struggle. You know, so you just got to never give up.
Do you have a favorite moment from shooting, or maybe a moment that you witnessed on set that really stuck out to you?
Sure. My favorite scene, I love the movie beginning to end, but my favorite scene is the nighttime baseball game where the fireworks are going off and Ray Charles is singing America the Beautiful. It always, to this day, when I watch that scene, I cry. It's just, because that wasn't my childhood. That's the way my childhood should have been. You know what I mean? It's my version of a nostalgia that I wish I could look back on. But, you know, I put it in a movie, so, you know, it kind of is. One of my favorite moments in the making of the movie was after, you know, I'd written it and pre-produced it and got the crew together, was when my production designer came to my office and we shot it in Utah, in Salt Lake City, and said, all right, we're ready. And he took me across the street where we had built the sand lot. There was just an empty lot. So everything there, we built it. And walking onto the sand lot for the first time and seeing it in three dimensions, it had come to life. That was pretty overwhelmingly awesome.
You mentioned that you guys are going around and showing it at different ballparks. What are you most looking forward to about this reunion tour?
Oh, you know, look, this is just going to be a gigantic love fest. So who wouldn't want to do that? You know, I get to hang out with the guys and some of the crew members, producer and all that. The reunion is always, just about hugging it out. It's fantastic. One thing I really like, though, is meeting fans, you know, and shaking hands with them. And, you know, they tell me how much they love the movie. And I tell it that it wouldn't be the same. It wouldn't be what it is without them. And you know, it's just a remarkable sense of gratitude to get to be able to do that, you know, in a writing and directing career. I mean, who gets to do that? Nobody, you know, so it's pretty special.
Whenever I come across a list of greatest baseball movies, I find that The Sandlot's often mentioned alongside Major League, Field of Dreams, Bull Durham, and Pride of the Yankees. Do you have a favorite baseball film?
Other than The Sandlot?
Other than The Sandlot.
I'm a huge fan of The Natural, a huge fan of Field of Dreams, and The Bad News Bears, the original. I think those are probably my three favorites. I could watch those over and over and over, never get tired of them.
You we mentioned Maury Wills earlier in the interview, but do you have a favorite Dodger?
Currently, I'd say Clayton Kershaw for sure. He's remarkable. I just love to watch that guy work. He's something else.
What do you think is the greatest moment in Dodger history? Sandy Koufax or Kirk Gibson?
Kirk Gibson.
That was easy.
I am a massive Sandy Koufax fan. I know exactly what you're talking about. But in my estimation, that Gibson, when Gibby hit that rocket, that has got to be one of, if not the five, one of the three greatest moments in sports history. Not just baseball, sports history. You know?
Yeah.
Absolutely astounding. Impossible. He did the impossible.
I mean, that series happened the year I was born, and I still see video footage of it all the time.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I've heard the story about, because his hamstrings are all messed up, and he was injured, and it was this clutch stitch, and Captain Tommy, I think, said something like, Gibby, you know, I got to send you out there. Can you do it for us? He goes, I'll try, Cap. Like right out of a movie.
My understanding was that he came up and Vin Scully basically said he's basically going to have to hit one out if he wants to do anything. And then he did.
Yeah, I don't remember that, but that sounds about right, yeah.
We've mentioned Kershaw, we've mentioned Gibbons, we've mentioned Koufax. Who is the greatest Los Angeles Dodger of all time?
I got to visit the Dodgers this year. Wow, that's a tough call. I mean, Koufax has got to be in there.
Right.
Jeez Louise. I mean, with all the iconic guys from the 70s, you know, Say and Garvey and all that. And, you know, just for the love of the game, you got to throw Fernando in there. I think it would have to be Koufax, I think. Who would you say?
Well, I was going to ask, would you consider, I mean, although Jackie played for the Brooklyn Dodgers, would you consider him part of that franchise?
There's no question. I thought he would just meant the LA Dodgers. But, yeah, if you want to go back, then there's no question that Robinson's got to be top five, maybe top three.
Yeah. I would say him, and you're right, probably Koufax.
Yeah.
How would you rate their chances this year?
All I can do, Dan, is stand in front of the flat screen and cheer them on when I'm not there. I would say as good as last year, you know? I really do. I don't think we got injury problems. You know, Kershaw's firing on all cylinders, you know? They got a good bullpen. The sticks look good. I'd give them as good a shot as anybody else, and quite frankly, as good as last year. So, come on, boys, do it again.
What would you say to kids who are thinking about getting into filmmaking?
Don't. No, I'm joking. I would say, when you say kids, you mean like kids or
college
students or what?
Yeah, like, you know, high schoolers, you know, young aspiring filmmakers.
First things first, watch as many movies as you possibly can. Bad ones as well as good ones. Fill your mind with cinema. Two, read as many scripts as you possibly can. Know what good writing is, what good storytelling is. You know, good storytelling trumps good writing every time, but that doesn't mean you can be sloppy. Know what makes a good screenplay. Learn what goes on in every single department, from craft service all the way up to the director. Know how to make a movie. You know, a lot of people that go into motion pictures or television or whatever, you know, they wouldn't, you know, what's a gaffer, you know? What do the grip electric guys do? You got to know that. You have to know all of that stuff. You know, you should be able to do every job on that picture if you're called upon to do so. Obviously, you find your niche. You want to write, produce, whatever you end up doing, fine. You know, specialize. But you should know every single thing. That to me has been, I've had a lot of trouble with producers or people in my career who ask utterly time-wasting questions when they should know the answer. You know, I mean, every day on set is 1,000 different decisions for a director. You know, and the best directors are the ones that can limit those questions and also have the answers. And if it's a really, really difficult business to get into, but once you're in, never give up, ever, under any circumstances, and you got to work your butt off, because if you don't, there's 100 people behind you waiting to take your job.
Yeah.
So that's what I'd say in a practical sense.
Well, The Sandlot is celebrating its 25th anniversary by going on a baseball tour. David Mickey Evans, thanks so much for speaking with me today, and have fun on the reunion tour.
I certainly will, Dan. Thanks for having me. I appreciate it very much.
Alrighty, have a good day. Cheers.
You too. Bye-bye. Cheers.
That was David Mickey Evans, who is the writer-director of the classic baseball film, The Sandlot, which is now celebrating its 25th anniversary this year. And as David mentioned, they will be taking the film to ballparks around the United States. Something else that is happening this weekend is a televised musical. In this case, it's Jesus Christ Superstar Live in Concert, which NBC is airing on Sunday. And it has a great cast. John Lennon is playing Jesus. Sarah Bareilles is Mary Magdalene. Alice Cooper is playing King Herod. Norm Lewis is Caiaphas. And Brandon Victor Dixon is playing Judas Iscariot. But something else interesting happened a couple weeks ago. There's a group here in Toronto. Well, it's a couple of guys called Choir. And you may remember I had them on the show in the beginning of last year. And it's run by Nobu Edelman and David Goldman. And what they do is they take pop songs or, you know, songs from musicals and rework them for a choral arrangement and then invite members of the public to come sing along with them. And they've done some good things. They've done Leonard Cohen. They've done David Bowie. They did Hallelujah, I think, at the Women's March. They've done Pride Marches. They've done all sorts of things. And a couple weeks ago, NBC had gotten in touch with them and asked if they wanted to do a couple of pieces for Jesus Christ Superstar Live. And they said yes. And so the NBC crew actually came to Toronto and Choir put a call out, and it was one of the biggest crowds they've ever had. And they did two songs. They got to do Superstar, the most well-known song, and the song Simon Zelotes. But they sung those songs not only with all the choir members, with David on guitar and Nobu conducting, but Brandon Victor Dixon came and sung Superstar, and Eric Grunwald, who plays Simon Zelotes, came and sung that song as well. I had the honor of being a part of that sing-along, and it was incredibly, incredibly fun. Both the videos are out now on the Choir Facebook page. Eric singing Simon Zelotes, you can see him crowd surf at the end of the song. And Brandon Victor Dixon sort of walks through at the beginning and parts the crowd. And what was really interesting is that we recorded it at the Great Hall, and it was quite bright. I mean, not only just with all the set lights and TV lights, but we shot it in the afternoon, so there's a lot of natural light. And when you look at the videos, it's quite... They've eliminated a lot of that extra light, so the look is stunning. I encourage everyone to go and check it out. Choir, Jesus Superstar, Jesus Christ Superstar Live. They sing with both Brandon Victor Dixon and Eric Grunwald. I had the chance to speak with Eric Grunwald just a couple of days ago about his role in this, and I'd never heard of him before, I'm ashamed to say. He had won Swedish Idol back in 2009 with his hard rock, heavy metal singing and swagger. And he is also currently lead singer of the band Heat in Sweden. And they've released two albums, Address the Nation and Tearing Down the Walls. And so we talked about, you know, the differences between heavy metal and Broadway, but also the differences between being on Swedish television versus being on American television. No surprise, Eric found the difference quite startling. Anywho, this is my interview with Eric Grunwald, who plays Simon Zelotes in Jesus Christ Superstar Live. Eric Grunwald, hello, welcome to the show. How are you doing today?
Hey, I'm very good. Thanks for having me. I'm very good. I'm rehearsing for the Jesus Christ Superstar Live in concert, so I'm very excited about it.
It's about 4 days until you guys go live. How are rehearsals going for you? Putting the final touches on everything?
Yeah, well, it's getting more and more
more intense, and I think we have everything under control. It feels like it. More things are getting added every day, and there's more people coming in every day. And it's just an amazing production to be a part of, and definitely feels like everything is under control. So, yeah. Look forward to the show.
You're a heavy metal hard rock singer. How much has this process been similar or different for you compared to doing sort of a regular rock concert?
Oh well, it's definitely more choreography that I have to practice more choreography and sync with the rest of the cast in a different way than what I'm used to. I mean, when I'm on stage, I just do what I do, and I move the way I want. But here, it's definitely we have to sync everything, and I've never had to be this focused actually as I am now. So I'm really it's a bit different in that way. But other than that, I mean, I'm just the big character that I play, he's pretty much, it's pretty much the same guy, just a lot of energy and a lot of joy and power. So that's basically who I am on stage when I'm out touring with the band as well.
Were you a big fan at all of Broadway or of musical theater growing up?
Well, I mean, I did a few musicals in school, like in school production. I did We Will Rock You in school, and I actually did Jesus Christ Superstar as well. But I mean, Broadway is a new world to me. So that's something completely new, and I've never experienced anything like it. So I'm excited about it, and it's cool, you know.
Just in terms of, you know, the technical aspect of singing. How different in terms of the type of singing that you have to do or the ways in which you have to prepare your voice, how different is what you normally do versus Jesus Christ Superstar?
There's no difference at all. I just do the same thing, same warm up, same techniques, you know. There's no difference there at all. So just same old Eric.
I find that Broadway can tend to be a little bit higher, like sort of in the tenor range especially for a lot of male singers. Is that something that came easy to you? Is that your natural range at all, would you say?
Yeah, absolutely. But the thing I noticed was that everyone here is just amazing singers. I've never been in a cast or even close to working with people this talented. So, you know, I really, like I said, I've never had to be this focused focus on giving the best I've got. So, I mean, people are insanely talented, and everyone in the cast, I think someone told me that everyone in the cast has had a lead in a Broadway show. Like the elite, you know. I basically have no idea what I'm doing here.
as a rock star, how cool was it for you to get to basically perform alongside Alice Cooper?
Well, that's amazing. I actually met Alice once. He played at a festival in Sweden, and we played at that same festival, and we said hello to him in his dressing room, but I don't think he remembers that. And I mean, Alice Cooper is a legend, so that's just amazing. I mean, it's going to be cool. I haven't met him yet, actually, because he hasn't been here when I've done my numbers. So, but I'll meet him soon enough.
Have you gotten a chance to meet John Legend at all yet?
Oh yeah. We've been working this week together. So he just got back from a tour in Asia. So it's been great. Great guy.
How does your home country of Sweden feel about this? Because you're sort of the only non-American in the main cast.
Yeah, well, I think they are. I mean, I get a lot of press and a lot of interview requests. So feels like Sweden's got my back and that they are proud of me doing this. So that feels good. Feels like I've got support from Sweden.
A couple weeks ago, you and co-star Brandon Victor Dixon did something very interesting. You actually came here to Toronto to do something special with Choir. And I understand that was your first time in Canada. What was that experience like for you?
Well, everything's just been very, very crazy since I found out about this, that I was doing this musical live production in like 2 months ago, and it's just been a crazy journey. And I remember waking up before I went to New York, and I told my girlfriend that I would like to go to Canada someday. And the day after, we got the request about doing this thing with a choir, and actually going to Toronto and record it. And it's just been, I think that was, I didn't get to see Toronto that much, but it was definitely an amazing experience, and I will remember it all my life, you know.
I'm friends with those guys at Choir, so I was there that day. What was it like for you just sort of being in that environment and getting to not necessarily perform for, but perform with all these people, essentially?
Well, I think that they were amazing singers, all of them, and there was a lot of positive energy in that room. Seems like people were just having a good time and performing these amazing songs by Andrew Lloyd Webber and Tim Rice, and it was just a good vibe in general.
You're used to performing live, obviously being a singer and a rock star, but is there a different mindset for you in terms of you're performing live, but you're also performing live on television?
Well, not really. I try not to think about it that much. I just do what I do and try to focus on delivering to my full potential. A few years back, I won the Swedish version of Idol, and I guess I had some experience of doing live shows like television and stuff like that from doing Idol. So I try not to think about it, and it's still go up and deliver and do. It's just like any rock show, basically. Just go up and do what you do.
But do you find that American television is a lot different or a little bit more intense, maybe than Swedish television at all?
Oh yeah, I mean this production is just crazy. It's like I've never experienced anything like it. And like I said, it's like people are so professional, so talented, and this is a new level, a completely new level. And I'm just very honored to be a part of that, and that they actually found me. So, good times.
You play the role of Simon Zelotes, which is, he's not necessarily a well-known figure either in the Bible or in the production. Was there anything you did in terms of preparing for the role? Did you watch other people play the role? Did you read up on him, or did you just read what you were given and go with that?
Well, I watched the movie a couple of times, and I think that guy is great. He's just seems like a crazy guy, and I think Simon is a bit crazy. You know, he wants Jesus to lead his followers and use his power to go into battle against the Romans. So I watched the movie a couple of times, but then I did what I think Simon should be like,
In a show like this, there's singing and there's also acting. Is that something you think that's going to be part of your future more, more acting or sort of more blending of music and acting and performance?
Yeah, well, I definitely like acting, and I definitely think that I will. I mean, every performance includes some kind of acting. I mean, when you're out touring with your band, you're not the same guy off stage as you are on stage. So, I guess that's something that's included everywhere. The acting comes with the. It's included as a performing artist, so I feel very comfortable with it. It's just the choreography that's been most challenging to me.
And now I know that you've done a few things like this before. I wanted to ask you about performing. Is this true that you did the Queen musical We Will Rock You a number of years ago?
Yeah, exactly. That was a school production, yeah. That was like the first thing I did as an artist, as a performing artist. So that's when I studied guitar in school, but I started singing instead and focused on that after that musical.
What would you mentioned Swedish Idol, which you won in 2009. That as an empire. What was the Idol experience like for you?
That was a complete life changer. I mean, just everything got different after that, and it was an amazing experience. It was I would say it was actually a blessing and a curse, because you didn't really know how to handle the media and everything, and they don't prepare you for it. You just get kind of like thrown into that media circus, but you learn and get better at it. And I mean, if I hadn't done that, I wouldn't be here today. So I'm grateful for it.
Speaking of the media, especially, I mean, the States has an unbelievable culture of celebrity and sort of an obsession with fame. But what's it like over in Sweden, over in Europe? Is it the same, or do people maybe not care as much as they do over here?
Well, I think we have, I mean, we have that in Sweden as well, but I mean, in America, everything is bigger. Sweden is a very small market. We got a population of 10 million people. So, I mean, everything is bigger here. And I would say that's the biggest difference.
The performance itself is airing on Sunday. What are you most looking forward to about it?
To show the audience and people watching how much work and how professional this production is. Because, I mean, I literally walk around right now looking at the set and looking at the people and the production, and I'm just amazed by how hard they've been working and how good this is going to turn out. It's going to be amazing, and I just look forward to show it to you guys.
What do you think the first thing you'll do is once you're done with the show on Sunday night?
I will go to a bar and have a cold beer.
Good plan. What's a good Swedish beer that you like?
I actually have my own beer brand in Sweden called Hadraya, so I have to say that.
Oh. Wait, can we can we can, can we
So,
can we get it in this part of the world yet?
well, maybe soon. I'm working on it.
How does one start their own brand of beer? Was it just sort of
through an endorsement deal, or was it something that you sort of always wanted to do and just went ahead and did it?
No, well, I just got an idea. I mean, the name is from a Swedish movie classic, so it's a Swedish thing, Hadraya. But my friend actually owns a brewery, so I contacted those guys and told them that I had this idea, and I own the name, and they own the recipe, and yeah, so that's how it all started. And it's been out in Sweden now for, let's see, it's 5 years, yeah.
And finally, I wanted to ask you about Heat, the band. I know you guys just put out, I think, a new album last year. Are we going to see a new album or a tour anytime within the next, you know, year or so?
Yeah, well, we're actually writing for a new album right now, and we'll be out touring most of 2018, but we'll definitely start releasing new songs in the beginning of 2019. And start touring on that. So hopefully we'll have a new album out by fall 2019.
All right. Well, Jesus Christ Superstar Live airs Sunday, Easter Sunday, April 1st. Eric Grunwald is playing the role of Simon Zelotes, and also his band Heat's new album is Into the Great Unknown. Eric, thanks so much for joining me today, and break a leg on Sunday, and best of luck with the rest of rehearsals.
Thanks a lot for having me. Thank you so much. You guys, I mean, you will like this.
we look forward to seeing it on Sunday. All right, man. Take care. Ciao.
Okay. Thank you. You too. Take care. Bye.
That was my conversation with Eric Grunwald, winner of Swedish Idol in 2009, and he stars as Simon Zelotes in Jesus Christ Superstar Live, airing Sunday, April 1st on NBC. That does it for me today. Be sure to check the show out on Facebook and Twitter at Endeavors Radio. And if you like what you hear, please consider donating on Patreon, patreon.com/Endeavors. Thanks for tuning in, and I'll see you next time. Bye for now. Go, Jays, go!